listeners, this is Robert from Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Let me tell you about my company, Gulfstream Motorsports, Inc. 727-541-1741. I have over 35 years' experience with classic, vintage, sport, and racing cars. I do appraisals, consulting, and pre-purchase inspections. Before you buy your next rare classic, the car of your dreams, give me a call at Gulfstream Motorsports, Inc., 727-541-1741. Also, due to my 28 years' experience in the auto salvage business, I am very good with wrecks. So if your car has been in a wreck, call me for a diminished value report. Call me at 727-541-1741. You may be owed some money for lost value of your repaired vehicle. That's Gulfstream Motorsports, Inc., 727-541-1741. And be sure to tune in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars, Wednesdays, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Tantalk Radio Network, AM 1340. If you like golf, enjoy affordable golf at Magnolia Valley Golf Club, located on Massachusetts Avenue in Newport Richey. Play for as little as $15 after 2 p.m. The club has two beautiful courses to choose from, an 18-hole championship par 72, plus another 9-hole executive par 33. Join their open leagues on Wednesday afternoons at 4 and Sunday mornings at 8. Call 727-847-2342 for tee times or visit their website, MagnoliaValleyGolfClub.com.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to have you with us. This is The Late Show. We're coming to you tonight again from London. This, of course, is Peter O'Toole. What a magnificent entrance. What kind of camel was it? I don't know anything about that.
That one?
Yeah.
It's a little zoo camel. I think it's a sweet little guy. I've not been on one for 34 years.
34 years? And when was the last time you were on one? Was that for Lawrence of Arabia? Oh, my God. How much time during the making of that motion picture did you spend on a camel, and why didn't you keep up with it after the film?
Well, as you can see, I have done.
Yeah.
The trouble is parking. There's no difficulty in parking, exactly. Uh-huh. It's the traffic wardens. When they come with their parking tickets, they don't know where to stick them. I could make a few suggestions.
No. Omar Sharif and you on camels, is there...
Well, Omar is in London, and he was going to come down with us tonight. We were going to pull a gag on you.
Oh.
At last, he's rehearsing.
Oh, too bad.
But if you remember the film Lawrence of Arabia, there was a famous scene of a charge at Aqaba in which my face was described by Time magazine as with a look of messianic determination as we charged. What in fact happened was we'd been in Arabia for 9 months. When we came to do the charge at Aqaba, we were in Spain. On the east coast of Spain. And Aqaba had been built on the seafront. Well, no racing camels, no sweet things like Topsy. Yeah.
Racing camels are thoroughbreds in the camel family.
In the camel family.
They go.
They do, 30 miles an hour.
Is camel racing popular?
In Arabia?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I don't think it would take off here.
No.
Royal Ascot, can you imagine the Queen? Well, came the day of the charge, and we were given Moroccan plow camels who had never had a human being on their hump.
Right.
Poor loves, they'd just been...
It's an interesting phrase. I'm just turning it over a couple of times.
I watched it turn over. And, of course, these poor little things were floundering around, and they'd never been ridden. They didn't know what to do. And we were doing a mile down a shaley hill with lots of cameras on helicopters and one thing and another. 50 camels and 400 horses. Well, it was going to be very, very dangerous indeed.
Yes.
So I went to the caravan, which Omar and I were sharing. And there he was. And as you may know, Omar is a gambling man.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking very solemn. And I said, what are you thinking about, Omar? He said, well, I'm working out the odds, Peter. I said, what odds, Omar? He said, whether or not the camel will fall over or whether I will fall off the camel. The odds on the camel falling over are 6-4 against, but the odds of me falling off the camel are even money. I saw the sense of that. He said, so what do you intend to do? He said, I'm going to tie myself onto the camel.
Is that a good idea, do you think?
I said to him, is that a good idea, do you think? And he said, it's absolute logical sense.
Right.
This is the odds. I've got Eddie the prop man, and he's going to tie me around and look at him. So I thought, well, I don't really fancy being adhere to a camel. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that, Emma. I'm going to get drunk.
That's an option right there. Always an option.
And Omar said, oh, I'm going to get drunk as well.
So he's tied to a camel and drunk.
So we got a bottle of brandy and two bottles of milk, and we drank the brandy and the milk. And, of course, by this time, we were supremely confident of doing anything.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, a little milk will do that for you.
But he was tied to the camel. Off went the rocket. Boom. And, of course, the camels, out of sheer terror, bolted. And this look of meiotic, messianic determination on my face was, in fact, a drunk actor.
Yeah.
Okay, listeners, welcome, and you are tuned into Nostalgic Radio in Cars, and I'm your host, Robert. So, hey, welcome to the show, everybody. Hey, Lee, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Robert. Thanks for asking.
That's good. You like that clip we just played?
Yeah, I remember seeing that, you know, when it was originally aired on Letterman. It was hysterical. I mean, Peter O'Toole is one of the funniest guys on the planet.
Yeah, he always had a little bit of an inebriation problem.
He was wasted that night. I mean, you know, there's no two ways about it. He didn't even walk out from behind the car. He just sort of drifted over to the chair, you know. Just looked like he was, like, floating on air. It was amazing.
That's cool. Well, anyway, our guest tonight is a Peter O'Toole fan, and that's why we played that for him. And so, anyway, we got a really cool guest for you. We had a couple good songs, and we got that first song queued up there, Lee?
Yes, we do.
Okay, you can run to your computers and Google TANTALK1340.com, and you can see us live in the studio. And if you're out of our range, which is the Tampa Bay area here, you can we're streamed live on the internet. So tell all your friends, call them all over the planet real quick, even the ones in Mars, and they can all listen to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. Okay, let's fire up that turntable.
Has a beard. Has a mustache. You come into me with that soulful look on your face. Come in looking like you never ever done one wrong thing. Has a beard.
Okay, we are back. And again, you are tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and we got a great show for you tonight. That's one song down, one to go, and then we got to get ready for our really cool guest this evening. I got a really interesting guy here tonight. This guy's well-known. I'll give you a little hint. You'll see him on television. And you've seen him on television, and you will be seeing him in the very near future on TV as well. And so, anyway, not only is he a Peter O'Toole fan, but he's also a Cream fan. So that's a song for our guest this evening. Anyway, a couple updates. Hey, keep in mind, next week is Barrett Jackson, Russo and Steele, Gooding, RM auction. All that stuff's going on out in Scottsdale. We've got the 24-hour race coming up at the end of the month. Okay, so we got a bunch of stuff. And Mecum's got their auction coming up at the end of the month here in Florida, in Kissimmee. So put that on your calendar, and hope to see everybody there. Also, let's see, I want to say a big shout out to my friends over there at Cop Car Online. That's John and Mark over there, 727-536-2677, 536-2677. I'll get that straight one of these days. And I need to slow down when I talk. I know that. But at any rate, and then let's see what else we got going on. Oh, yeah, hey, a few weeks ago we had Norm Grabowski. Actually, last week we had Norm Grabowski on the show, and he was gracious enough to send me a couple really, really cool posters. I am working on a website. When I get my website up, I'm going to have a lot of this stuff displayed, some of this cool stuff that I get from some of our guests, which is really, really neat. But check out Norm Grabowski's website. Just type in Norm Grabowski and all the information will pop up. He's a really cool guy. He's got some real interesting story. And if you happen to be out in the Midwest, one of the car shows out there, you know, pop in and say hi. And also, Daryl Starberg was on our show a few, I think, last month, beginning of the month in December. And he was gracious enough to send me a book. It's called Daryl Starberg, The Bubble Top King. And it's an amazing book. It's a beautiful hardback book with some outstanding pictures of really cool custom cars that he started building in the early 50s, 60s, 70s. And he's still building stuff. And he's got a huge custom car museum out in Oklahoma. So if you happen to be in the Oklahoma area, if you're on vacation out there or on business out there, be sure and stop in and check his place out. His museum. It's really, really, really cool. And it's very, very historical. Also, something else, I just got an email here today from our friends at SEMA. And I'll find out a little bit more about this, but I guess they've been working. SEMA is very, very instrumental in working with all the people associated with the aftermarket parts business. So whether you're building intake manifolds, headers, custom tires and wheels, whether you build accessories for cars, interior pieces, exterior pieces, you know, hard parts, any of that kind of stuff, SEMA is huge. And that shows usually in November. But anyway, it's a very, very, very well-organized organization, actually. And they are really, really in our corner as far as keeping the hobby and industry alive. And I guess they have been working with, and I got to find out a little bit more about this, but the email basically said that they've been working in conjunction with the U.S. government. Now, everybody knows that the government's been trying to hammer all us in the car collector business and the field, saying basically, you know, our cars are polluters, they're, you know, they don't meet safety standards. I mean, the list of reasons why they don't want classic and collectible cars on the market is, it's huge. But SEMA is evidently working with a couple of senators and some representatives, and some are Democrats and some are Republicans, believe it or not. They actually got some lefties out there that are car collectors. And on July 13th, they're trying to make that the Collector Car Appreciation Day. So that's July 13th. And what they're urging everybody to do is, if you have a collector car or a classic car or a collectible car of any kind, put together car clubs, groups, meetings. It's kind of like a celebration day, you know. So, you know, like you've got the 4th of July. Well, it's, you know, celebrate independence. Well, now we're going to have July 14th to celebrate Collector Car Appreciation Day. And if you can't do anything on July 13th, what they're suggesting is that the whole month of July, just to kind of dedicate that to collector car enthusiasts out there. And the whole idea is to basically, let's keep the sport alive. Let's keep the hobby alive. And, you know, they're making concessions. They know that we don't drive our cars that much and our cars aren't big pollutants. In fact, there's a lot of people that are doing stuff that would be considered green these days. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of technology. There's alternative fuel sources that they are working on that are actually done in a laboratory. So hopefully in the next few years, you know, if government stays out of the way, we can get some really cool stuff out there and we won't be, you know, fuel won't be an issue for us anymore. You know, I mean, high octane fuel, because a lot of us run high compression cars. Although today with electronics and stuff like that, all the newer cars that have all the electronics, you know, obviously they can run, you know, this terrible fuel that we got out there, this low octane, just one step above water, garbage that we've got to tank up all the time. But those of us that run the older cars, you know, which has basically, you know, either points or anemic version of some sort of electronic ignition or something like that, and some compression, we can't run that junk gas. We have to either run AF gas or some sort of a high octane, you know, 100 plus octane fuel. But nonetheless, you know, if you've got any kind of compression. So at any rate, so let's go ahead and let's run a couple commercials real quick, and then we'll call our guests, and we got this really, really neat guy coming on tonight. So I'm looking forward to him. Oh, yeah, real quick. The 10th, 11th caller this evening, I've got another gift certificate to Krabby's Beachwalk Bar and Grill. So if you call in, you're the 10th. Let's just say the 10th caller, okay? Because we do get a lot of calls, but you got to count them. I mean, you can call back 10 times, you know, but we'll know who you are. So, Colin, we'll give you a gift certificate to Krabby's Beachwalk Bar and Grill. And then Rob called 2 weeks ago. He won one. So, Rob, if you're listening, somehow we misplaced your address and phone number. So I need to get that again. So, Rob, if you're listening, you call in. You don't get two. You'll get one. But my apologies. And but we shoot straight here. And everybody that calls in and qualifies for a gift certificate gets one. So, anyway, it looks like Lee's on the phone right now with a customer right now. Our customer. I'm still thinking in terms of business, but we're going to roll our next song real quick, and then we're going to have our guests on the line, and this should be a really, really good, interesting story. So stay tuned. You are tuned into Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and we'll be right back.
was the meaning of that phone call? Victor Laszlo is on that plane. Why do you stand here? Why don't you stop him? Ask Miss Ulrich. Get away from that phone. I would advise you not to interfere.
I was willing to shoot Captain Renault, and I'm willing to shoot you.
Hello.
Put that phone down.
Get me the radio tower.
Put it down.
Major Strasser has been shot. Round up the usual suspects. Well, Rick, you're not only a sentimentalist, but you've become a patriot.
Maybe, but it seemed like a good time to start.
I think perhaps you're right. It'd be a good idea for you to disappear from Casablanca for a while. There's a free French garrison over at Brazzaville. I could be induced to arrange a passage.
My letter of transit? I could use a trip. But it doesn't make any difference about our bet. You still owe me 10,000 francs.
And that 10,000 francs should pay our expenses.
Our expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Okay, we're back. You're tuned in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. And speaking of friends, it gives me great pleasure here shortly to welcome a very well-known voice, a very familiar name. He started his career with ESPN, did some stuff over at TBS. He's very well-known and very familiar to most of you car guys on the Speed Channel. He hosts a lot of motorsports events, and he'll be the host of Barrett Jackson next week. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the show this evening, Bob Varsha. Bob, are you there?
I sure am. Thanks for having me.
How you doing?
I'm doing just great, thank you.
So how are things up in Atlanta?
Well, a little cold right now and drippy, but that's okay. I was in Daytona last week for the Grand Am Roar before the 24 final test, and I know I'll be in sunny Scottsdale, Arizona on Friday, and 2 weeks after that down in Daytona for the Rolex. So I've got my my warm sunshine coming, and that's fine with me.
That's fine with you. Okay. Well, tell us a little bit how you got started, because I'm sure a lot of our listeners would like to know how you got into the industry and a little bit about your background.
Well, my background in college included athletics. I was a distance runner, and when I left school and came down to Atlanta to go to Emory Law School, thinking I was embarking on a legal career, I kept up with my running, went to a couple of Olympic trials in the marathon, and generally remained embedded in the running community here in Atlanta. We have a big event every 4th of July called the Peachtree Road Race, which is currently about 65,000 people on July 4th morning running down Peachtree Street, the main drag here in Atlanta. I directed that race for a few years. And then back in 1980, the folks at Turner Broadcasting decided they wanted to do a broadcast of the race and the spectacle. And somehow they got my name as somebody who knew the inside-out portion of the race. So they hired me, and I did a broadcast and didn't think twice about it. And then about 6 weeks later, they called me up and asked me if I wanted a job. So I kind of held them at arm's length while I established my legal career. And, well, within about 4 years, I realized that covering television sports was a lot more fun than what I was doing on the legal side. So I just asked them for a full-time job, and they gave me one. And, you know, away I went from there to ESPN and eventually to where I am now with what's known as Speed.
Now, when you first started covering sports back in the days, I mean, you started out with the running. I mean, it sounds like Peachtree Road Race, you would think it's a car race, but actually it's a marathon, isn't it, or it's a running race?
That's right. It's a foot race.
Okay.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution Peachtree Road Race. It wasn't 65,000 back then. It was only about 12,000, but by the standards of the day, that was a big crowd.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun time.
So then, all right, so you covered that, and there was other sports. I mean, you covered, say, gymnastics. You covered figure skating, snow, skiing.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about
that. While I was at Turner, they actually sent me to Korea for the opening of what were the Olympic Villages. There were two of them in preparation for the Seoul Summer Olympic Games. And that was in about 1984, right around the time of the Los Angeles Games. even though the Seoul Games were in 88. When I left CNN in 1984 and went over to ESPN, I fell into all manner of sports coverage. I would do gymnastics, figure skating, alpine skiing, Nordic ski racing, a little bit of running, and some motorsports. And the joke around ESPN was I was the first guy ever there to appear on all of their platforms simultaneously. And I was the guy, if there was a big event going on somewhere else, like Final Four, World Series, Super Bowl, whatever it was, which was not on ESPN, if you turned over to ESPN, you'd see me doing something like equestrian or figure skating or something that appeals to the female audience, because that's where ESPN tries to gather eyeballs when all the guys are watching the big-time game on another channel.
Well, now, when you to do a lot of these different sports, I mean, did you have to kind of like, was there a lot of preparation? Because, I mean, to cover equestrian, which is horse, you know, horse jumping and so on, or horse event, riding events, or skiing, or long distance running, or, you know, figure skating, you had to have some sort of, you got to be pretty sports minded, I would think, right?
So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a sports fan, and my legal training may have helped in this, in that I was used to doing research and taking a position, being an advocate, which is essentially what storytelling is presenting a point of view. So I had some skills there, and I'd learned some. And I found it a really attractive and fun challenge to go out and take a sport like, you know, three-day jumping in equestrian or archery or who knows what, and become expert enough in it so that I could lend some perspective during a broadcast. You know, my job was basically to do just that. Well, the color commentator sitting next to me or either side of me, those are the experts who would actually tell us whether that triple axel or, you know, that clay pigeon shot or, you know, whatever it might happen to be was good, bad, or indifferent. That wasn't up to me. My job was just to get us on the air, place the thing, give it some perspective, tell folks why it's important, identify the key players. And that takes some preparation, and that was a lot of fun to do because, you know, as I say, I like to tell stories, and sports is full of great stories, and there are lots of great stories in different sports, particularly someone like me who may not have known a lot about the given sport that I was talking to. I mean, take figure skating, for example, particularly in a pairs competition where the male member of the pair has to lift the female over his head in some of these really difficult athletic moves. A lot of those guys were former amateur hockey players, and those were some hard-living dudes, I can tell you. So, you know, people like that, just, you know, meeting folks like that and learning their individual stories, whether they got on the air or not, was a big attraction of the job for me and part of the reason I left the practice of law to do it.
Now, so basically, in your case, you kind of summarized everything, and then the color reporter, as you call it. Is it color reporter? Is that what you refer to?
He's
the guy that's...
Commentator or analyst or whatever you like to call him.
So he's like a specialist in that particular field, and he would actually do, let's say, like a play-by-play. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, I would do the play-by-play, basically, and then the analyst gets in and discusses, you know, the quality of the thing, why it's important, some technical nuance. So that's why so many of people who have that job are ex-athletes, mm-hmm. whereas the host/play-by-play guy, like my kind of job, if you go to a network like Jim Nance at CBS or Al Michaels over at NBC, you might sometimes find those guys covering various different sports because they don't have to be experts in the sport. They have to be more expert in television.
I see.
So they can move from sport to sport. But whereas, you know, your hockey analyst just does hockey, or your figure skating analyst just does figure skating, because that's where that's the culture they come from. That's the sport they know.
Well, I'm glad you came on the show, and I really thank you for doing so, because I get a chance mm-hmm. to talk about some other things. I mean, typically it's a car show, obviously, and motorcycles and stuff like that, but mm-hmm. what's interesting about your career is you've covered other areas of sports, and a lot of my listeners also like other sports. I mean, they do like ball sports, and they may like golf, because I know you've covered golf. They may like tennis, and they may like skating, or in my case, I'm a skier, so I love skiing, mm-hmm. and I was reading on one of your bios or some of the information I got on you that one of your... You covered the Honeycomb downhill in Kitzbühel back, you know, 20, I guess it was what, back in the 90s or something like that?
Back in the 90s, yeah. Not only the Honeycomb, that was a very special event. I mean, everybody knows the Honeycomb is probably the best known downhill event in the world, mm-hmm. and rightly so. But the World Cup Ski Tour, the FIS World Cup, would also come to North America to someplace like Vail or Aspen or Park City, and as well as some Canadian stops in places like Lake Louise. Mm-hmm. So we would cover those events as well. And fortunately, while I was at ESPN, we also hosted the World Alpine Championships at Vail one year. So the whole world came, and I got a chance to cover some really, really terrific Olympic quality ski racing, which was great fun.
Now, on the are you a skier yourself by any chance?
I am a bad skier, but I can ski, yeah.
Okay. One of my questions was, is of the sports that you commentate on, how many of them do you actually participate in?
Wow, that's a great question. I have raced.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everybody's ridden a bicycle, but that's not on the same planet as cycling at the level of the Tour de France, which I've also had the privilege of covering.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. You did that back in the 2000, back when Lance Armstrong was racing, right?
Right, when Lance was at his prime. 2001, I think, was Lance's third or fourth of his seven victories. That was when, I should back up, when I originally came to what was then called Speed Vision, later to become Speed, we had a sister network called Outdoor Life. And whereas Speed Vision was all about the internal combustion engine in its many forms, Outdoor Life was about, well, exactly what it sounds. It was canoeing and kayaking and skiing and cycling and that sort of thing, outdoor sports. Of course, when Fox bought us in 2001, they kept Speed Vision and relaunched it as Speed or Speed Channel. They sold off Outdoor Life to the Comcast people, and that then became Versus, and it's now NBC Sports. So, you know, the networks have gone through an evolution. But the beauty of going to a company with two signals was that I could cover motorsports and a lot of the other sports I liked, like cycling. And in 2001, I went over to France and just had an incredible time. I mean, I can hardly think of a better way to spend a July than driving around France in the summertime, sampling the food and wine and watching great athletes do their thing every day for an entire month.
Now, the how much at that particular event, are you stationary or do you kind of move around with the cyclists? How many miles is the Tour de France? I can't remember now, fans. That they cycle.
Well, every year it changes because the route changes every year and the number of stages and when the rest days are. Typically, it's, let's say, it's about 2,000 miles over 3 weeks.
Okay.
And the way we would cover it is we would have two sets of announcers or two crews, if you like, one at the starting point for the day's stage and another at the finish. And that's where I'd be located, was at the finish. And my job was basically to serve as a host. In addition to the United States, we were also providing English language coverage for several other English language countries, like Australia, for example. So I was working with probably the best cycling announcers in the world, Phil Liggett and Paul Sherwin, and they would basically handle the actual race commentary, and it would be my job to get us in and out of breaks for the American audience, because other countries around the world didn't take commercial breaks. So it would be my job at some point, they would tell Paul and Phil, 10-9-8-7-6-5-4-3-2-1, okay, pause for a second. They'd throw a switch. Those guys would go off of our air. I would come on, recap what had happened for about 3 minutes, and throw to a commercial break. Meanwhile, Paul and Phil were still talking to the rest of the world. Same thing in reverse. After the break, I'd welcome people back, explain what they missed during the commercial break, and then we'd all count down to one, and I would pause, and those guys would jump in and take over until the next commercial break. So it was complicated, but you always had to be on your toes, and it was just terrific.
Is there a tremendous amount, I mean, because we only see it on TV, but you having been there, is there a lot of spectators and enthusiasm and people there at those events during that whole three-week period, I mean, all along the course?
Absolutely, yeah, especially Americans. You know, with Lance doing as well as he did, the year I did it, 2001, was the first year on Versus, or Outdoor Life, as it was at the time. And a lot of folks got a little bent out of shape about that, including Lance, truth be told, because, you know, a lot of people think if you're not on ESPN, you're not a sport, you're not on television. And Lance was, you know, bothered that, you know, his exploits weren't going to be on ESPN. But ESPN had always done recorded highlights in a small 30 to 60 minute format, whereas we did live coverage of every day's stage for 3-4 hours or more. And once Lance and all the other cyclists and teams and so on got the kind of feedback that they did from the United States, which was enormously enthusiastic, there were people who were running out to buy airline tickets and grabbing their bikes and coming so they could ride along with the Tour de France once it was clear that it was so much fun and it was getting so much exposure and Lance and his team were doing so well, that we would not only find, you know, the French and the Germans and the Italians and all the other cycling-loving countries who will pitch their tents by the side of the road between the pavement and a 3,000-foot drop down into an alpine valley, which is a whole other story. But Lance kind of warmed up to us, and the whole thing really was a big success, I have to say. That was the one year I did it, and I loved every minute of it. It's just an amazing sport.
That's super. Now, you also covered, we'll digress a second, we'll pick it up a notch or two in terms of horsepower. You covered some Formula One races over in Europe. Tell us some about some of those, and particularly Monaco.
Well, right. Yeah, in the early days, we actually went to every race, which may sound odd to some of your listeners because they may be thinking, well, don't you go to all the races all the time? And the answer, as lots of fans know, is no, we do not. Our reporter, Will Buxton, is on the scene of the race, but my colleagues David Hobbs and Steve Matchett and I call the race off of a live satellite feed from our Speed Studios, which are in Charlotte, North Carolina. So really the only race that I have been to, and this whole process of doing it out of a studio began back in the ESPN days, probably about 1993, and by 96, I mean, we weren't going to any races. Then in 2001, of course, we had a United States Grand Prix at Indianapolis, and I was at Speed, and we went to that race all of its 7 years, as we will hopefully go to the return of the United States Grand Prix in Austin come this November, and then the Grand Prix of the Americas, which will be in New Jersey, across from Manhattan Island, in June of 2013. So it'll be good to get back on the road again, because it does make a difference in the broadcast. And back then, you know, I did travel the world to all of the races, 16 or 17 races a year, went to all these wonderful countries, got a zillion frequent flyer miles on airlines that don't exist anymore, like TWA, and had a wonderful time. Of course, that was all pre-9/11, which changed everything.
Now, of the F1 races that you had the great fortune to attend, and would you say Monaco is probably the prized F1 race? You know, it's kind of like Le Mans is the 24-hour race that everybody aspires to. Indy 500 is the Indy race. Would Monaco be the one that all the F1 drivers want to win? Would that be the creme de la creme?
Yeah, I think so. It's Monaco is an enigma in lots of ways. Everybody will tell you it's a ridiculous place to hold a race with a contemporary Formula One car. You know, it's just insane. The working conditions, even though they've improved a lot with the changes to the pit lane in recent years, the working conditions are still dire. It's a huge pain in the butt for everybody, but it is Monaco. You know, it is really the crown jewel on the Formula One schedule. It's the race every team and every driver want to win. It embodies the spectacle and the glamour and the pizzazz and even the decadence that is synonymous with Formula One Grand Prix racing. So, yes, that's the race a driver wants to win. Second, and a close second, I suppose, would be a driver's home Grand Prix. And you have the other grandee events like the Italian Grand Prix at Monza with its incredibly passionate crowds, or the British Grand Prix at historic Silverstone, or Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium in the Ardennes Forest, which is probably the most difficult track on the Formula One circuit. So I would say those are probably the key races. But Monaco is Monaco. It's different. It's like a prize fight in a phone booth, but it is a spectacular race to win, and every driver wants to.
Now, what are some of these new tracks like in Bahrain? And I know they've got one in Korea. I think there's a Formula One race over there. And I mean, what are these? These are brand new road courses, purpose built for F1. What are these tracks like? And what are the crowds like there?
Well, I couldn't tell you. I haven't been to any.
That's true.
The short answer. But now the new tracks are all reflective of the increased scrutiny on safety following 1994, when the three-time world champion Ayrton Senna was killed at the Imola circuit in Italy. The company that designs virtually all of the Formula One layouts, Tilke and Associates from Germany, have some very specific trademarks to their tracks. They look for corners with character. They look for straightaways followed by heavy breaking zones, which is said to be conducive to passing opportunities. At least it was before the advent of the kinetic energy recovery systems and the drag reduction systems, the DRS, the moving top element of the rear wing that has produced a ton of new passing in Formula One. The tracks, I suppose to a purist, the tracks were a little sanitary. Hopefully they include a lot of the spectator amenities that you expect in a modern-day racing facility, considering racing as entertainment. Some of them have been successful. I think it's fair to say, in all honesty, some of them have been less so. Some of them were built under fairly shaky circumstances. The track in Korea, even though it's held two races now and is a good track, it's struggling for viability. The track in Shanghai that the Chinese spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars on is in a difficult situation from an economic perspective right now. Malaysia's okay. Bahrain, of course, is an entirely different question because of the civil unrest there and the sort of unfortunate news we read day after day with the protests, the whole rise of the Arab Spring, and the way some of the ruling entities in these countries have treated their own countrymen. Bahrain is back on the schedule for next year, but human rights groups are asking Formula One not to go. It's going to be a very difficult decision for everybody involved, including us at Speed.
How about now Texas, Austin? They're building a brand new track, and again, it's the same company. Tilke, is that it? The German company?
Tilke. Yeah, Tilke.
Now, is that track's complete already, isn't it? That one's they're getting ready.
Not quite complete. The track is laid, but the buildings are coming out of the ground now.
Okay.
It's going to be spectacular, very fast, including tribute corners, if you will, sort of nods to some of the great corners in Formula One, like the carousel at the Nürburgring and Turn 9 at Istanbul with its four apexes, all taken at high speed with tremendous G-loading. Probably the signature corner at Austin is going to be Turn 1, which will be a blast past the main grandstand in the pits, a climb of 130, 140 feet or so, and then right at the top of that climb, heavy braking and a sharp left-hand corner. So the driver is basically going to feel like an astronaut. He's going to be blasting up into the Texas sky and then make a sharp left-hand turn and sweep off down the length of the project. And it's a big track. It's 3-plus miles. Probably triple the size of the physical facility at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. It's a big track, and hopefully we'll provide the forum for a great show come November.
So it's got elevations in it then?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, the rolling countryside southeast of Austin where the track is located just has a natural hilly terrain characteristic, but they've also moved some dirt and created some extra, you know, elevation changes and off camber corners and things that'll make it a real challenge. And I think the drivers and teams are going to like it.
Yeah, I think so too. It sounds like kind of like the European tracks because they've got elevations and all the turns and everything like that.
Absolutely.
I know. Everybody's going to want to know because we talked about just a little while ago is Bear Jackson's coming up. So tell us a little bit about your involvement with Bear Jackson, how you cover that, and how that all came about, and, you know, put your little spin on it.
Well, Bear Jackson on Speed started before I got there.
Right.
Just about the time the company began, we began working with the Bear Jackson Auction Company. Bear Jackson is probably the best-known auction in America because, unlike many other car collector auctions, which tend to be a little bit stuffy and a little bit elitist and sort of reserve entry to people who have paid a lot of money to be registered bidders or paid a lot of money to enter their cars to be auctioned, Bear Jackson kind of pioneered the idea of taking the auction to the people and opening up the collector car hobby to folks, not only those with deep pockets, but also those, you know, who just want to spend a few $1,000, find a terrific old car and enjoy it. And maybe they keep it, maybe they restore it and put it in a glass case, maybe they bring it back to the auction next year and sell it on. But in addition to opening up the catalog to a tremendous variety of cars in terms of value, they also invited the public in. And for a very low daily ticket price, You can go in and go right up to all the cars, and this year at Scottsdale, there'll be over 1,300 of them, including some very, very elite collections, some wonderful cars, including a Tucker Torpedo and beautiful coach-built Delahaye and lots of terrific vehicles of all shapes and sizes. But they get about 250,000 spectators at their big event in Scottsdale coming up in a couple of weeks, And the industry kind of had to get used to that. And, of course, television on hand opened it up to millions of viewers at home. And at first, I've been doing it for a little over 10 years now. I love it. Not only the Scottsdale event, which is the mothership, the oldest, in its 41st year this year, but they also do events at Palm Beach, Florida, and Orange County, California, and Las Vegas, Nevada. All are a little bit different in terms of the kind of cars that are there, the kind of bidders that are there. And so there's a little different buzz in the room every time they go to a different place. But Scottsdale's the one coming up, 1,300 vehicles, 250,000 spectators, a huge manufacturer's midway. I mean, every kind of food you can possibly imagine. There'll be music and fashion shows and lifestyle events and gosh, you name it. It is, in sum, it is the best value for the dollar for the guy or girl out there who loves everything connected with cars. I really believe that.
Now, you're kind of a car guy yourself. I mean, is there any particular mm-hmm. cars that you kind of, you know, watch that you you kind of favor a little bit?
And, gosh, yeah. You know, when it comes to Barrett Jackson is like the automotive equivalent of a smorgasbord. You
that's
can't
true.
Eat everything, but you want to taste everything.
Mm-hmm.
My personal favorite is something that Barrett Jackson specializes in. You know, every auction has something they do well. And Barrett Jackson does muscle cars very, very well. And I particularly like the larger muscle cars, the 4-seat cars like the Pontiac GTO and the Dodge Charger, those sorts of cars. And there's usually a bunch of them. We'll also have some of the classic cars that every collector wants, a beautiful 61 Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing. And the list goes on and on. It really is more than you could describe in the time we have available to us. But hopefully folks can watch some of our 40 hours of coverage on Speed and get a little taste of Barrett Jackson if they haven't already seen it.
So now it starts when? You start televising on Tuesday, right?
We start on Tuesday, the 7th, a week from Tuesday. Is that the 17th?
Mm-hmm.
We'll go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 6 days in all. The big days are Friday and Saturday, when we'll do 10 or 11 live hours continuously. We have all sorts of promotions, including our Haggerty Fantasy Bid competition for some great prizes. And this year, everybody who plays the Fantasy Bid game automatically is entered in a sweepstakes for a one-of-a-kind 750-horsepower Ford Racing prepared Shelby GT500 Mustang. This car is just unbelievable. I can't believe we're giving one of these things away.
Wow.
I also can't believe that I'm not eligible because I work for the company.
Oh. Well, now, speaking of Shelby, it's the 50th year of the Cobra. Are they doing mm-hmm. anything special for Carroll Shelby this year?
Absolutely. I think everybody's going to be doing something special
okay.
for Carroll Shelby. Old Shell is just an icon and a universal figure, but Barrett Jackson, which I believe is the auction with which he is most closely associated, yes, definitely will be doing special things to honor Shell, and hopefully we'll get him on the microphone and let his be his cantankerous old self and have some fun with him.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. After that, you're going to be coming back, and I guess in 2 weeks you'll be at the 24-hour race, right?
Yep, it'll be a pretty tight schedule. I'll spend about 10 days in Scottsdale with Barrett Jackson and then come back on the Monday, which I guess is the 23rd, and then get a couple of days to dump the suitcase and refill it. And on Wednesday, I'll be down at Daytona International Speedway getting ready for the 2 days of the Rolex 24.
Well, that's going to be super. And I'll tell you what, now I want to thank you for coming on the show. We're just about out of time here, but Bob, would you be willing to come on again and do some commentating for us and tell us about some of the events that you participate in?
Sure. Yeah, let's get together sometime after the end of January, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about after Barrett Jackson
okay.
and the Rolex.
All right. That's good.
Right.
Now, one of the other things, we'll cover this next, but I just wanted to also point out to some of our listeners that you've covered some drag racing. You've covered...
I have.
And how about rallies, road rallies? Have you covered some road rallies?
I have done some rallies. I've mm-hmm. done drag racing. I've done motorcycle racing. You name it. There aren't too many things out there with wheels and a motor that I haven't talked about at some time or another.
Well, that's super. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that the listeners know that you're just totally, I mean, as far from a commentator's perspective in sports, you've covered, mm-hmm. I mean, everything. I mean, you know, all kinds of ball sports, like I said, the equestrian, the figure skating, the skiing, mm-hmm. Tennis, mm-hmm. golfing, you know, all facets of motorsports. So that's amazing. And that's good that you're up on all that stuff. And it just goes to show the listeners that car guys do know more than just cars, don't we?
That's right. And proud of the fact.
Okay. Well, anyway, Bob, I want to thank you for coming on the show. And my listeners, I want to tell everybody that we had Bob Varsha from Speed Channel, and he'll be on, you get to see him next week on Bear Jackson. He'll be on Speed, and then he'll be commentating on the 24-hour race coming up here at the end of the month. So, Bob, I want to thank you for coming on the show, and we'll look forward to seeing you in the future.
Thanks, Robert. Anytime.
All right. Thank you. All right. Hey, I want to tell everybody out there, thanks for tuning in to Nostalgic Radio and Cars. See you next week. Drive carefully, stay safe, and love your family. We're out of here. Hey, listeners. This is Robert from Nostalgic Radio and Cars. We all love to eat. Well, I would like to tell you about my friends at the Rib Shack Barbecue on West Bay Drive in downtown Largo. Their menu offers family-sized takeout dinners like delicious ribs, chicken, beef, and pork, or sit-down barbecue dinners, sandwiches, and even desserts. They will also cater your party. Everything is barbecued fresh using real oak for that great smoky flavor. So visit my friends Corey, Jed, and Kurt at the Rib Shack Barbecue in downtown Largo, 600 West Bay Drive, or call them for a takeout order at 727-501-9090. That's 727-501-9090. They truly have the best smoking barbecue in town. Oh, and be sure and check out their great barbecue sauce. Hey, listeners, this is Robert from Nostalgic Radio and Cars. As most of you know, I'm in the car business, and often I need cars towed. Well, Kotakis Towing has all the trucks and equipment to meet your needs, whether it's long distance, short distance, or just around the corner. They can get it done. Kotakis Towing, located at 1141 Court Street in Clearwater. Also, they have a full-service repair and body shop to meet all your automotive needs. So give my friends Lefty and Joey a call at Kotakis Towing at 727-447-1952. And be sure to mention Nostalgic Radio and Cars, and you might get a discount.